I was born in darkness, in the depths of a dying world. On Krieg, we are all born in darkness, if born is even the right word. The sun never touches us here. I've lived my entire life beneath the surface of Krieg, under miles of rock and ash, breathing recycled air that tastes of metal and dust. They say on some worlds the sky is blue and open. I wouldn't know. The only sky I've ever seen is the vaulted rock-crete ceiling of our subterranean city, and the only sun a thousand sputtering lumen globes trying to keep the darkness at bay. My earliest memory is the sound of the bunker's morning siren echoing through concrete corridors. It's a harsh, screeching wail that jolts you from sleep and reminds you, as if you could forget, that your life isn't your own. 4:30, every day, without fail. That siren is as close as we get to an alarm clock or a rooster's crow on Krieg. It's not like the outside world will give us a dawn. Down here, dawn is scheduled by the Departamento Munitorum, and it sounds like a drill alarm. I blink awake in the near dark, surrounded by rows of bunks and sleeping forms. There are dozens of us packed into this hab-block dormitory. Men, women, though such distinctions matter little, all of us dressed in the same coarse gray fatigue uniforms, each bunk with the same standard-issue blanket and storage trunk. Personal possessions are, well, not really a thing on Krieg. What would we even keep? A family heirloom? We don't have families the way off-worlders do. A toy? Childhood is brief and utilitarian here. A photograph. There are no scenic vistas or joyous moments to capture for posterity. My bunkmate once found a little tin trinket, a half-melted aquila from the ruins above. He keeps it polished and tucked in his pocket as a good luck charm. The officers would confiscate it if they knew. Personal sentiment is a luxury we can't afford. But he's convinced it's saved him from death at least twice. Who am I to argue? We all cling to something, even if we pretend we don't. The air is cold when I sit up, cold enough that I can see a faint mist of my breath. The heating must be low again. Rationing, always. I tug on my rebreather mask hanging at the side of the bunk. Technically, the air in here is supposed to be safe. The purifier units churn away day and night to keep our atmosphere breathable, but it's more a habit than anything. Most of us feel naked without a mask. Besides, the purifiers aren't perfect, and every now and then a pocket of bad air or a whiff of surface toxins slips through. You don't want to be the poor bastard caught without a mask when that happens. So I strap mine on, hearing the familiar hiss as it seals. The world becomes a little smaller, a little more distant behind the lenses of my respirator. But that's comforting in its own way. On Krieg, a mask feels more natural than an open face. We dress in silence, as always. There's not much chatter first thing in the morning. A few mumbled prayers to the God Emperor, the rustle of cloth as uniforms are donned, the clank of someone fastening the buckle on their trench coat, or the click of a helmet being secured. We're all expected to be fully kitted and ready for inspection within 5 minutes of that siren, even though we're not on the front lines, not yet. Discipline is everything. If you can't assemble yourself and your gear before the echo of the wake-up call fades, you're not worthy to serve, and the Emperor forbid you keep the rest of your bunkmates waiting. By 4:35, I'm standing at attention in the central corridor outside the dorm, along with everyone else from my block. We stand in neat rows, backs straight, boots together, eyes forward. Even through my mask's lenses, I can see the faint clouds of our collective breath in the chilly air. No one speaks. You could hear a pin drop if there were any pins left in this world, not hammered into ammunition. A lone officer, our block overseer, a grizzled man with a Vox amplifier built into his augmetic larynx, walks down the line inspecting. He doesn't need to say anything. His gaze and the occasional sharp tap on a slack shoulder or crooked cap say more than words. I focus on a spot on the wall and stand as rigid as a post. When he's satisfied, he gives a curt nod. We recite the morning litany in unison, voices muffled but fervent behind our respirators. The Emperor is our father and our judge. We exist to serve his will. Our lives are the coin we pay for the sin of our past. In his service, redemption. In his light, purification. The familiar words rumble in my chest. I speak them without thinking now, but I try to find meaning in them each day, lest I become numb. Today my throat is dry and the litany catches slightly. I hope the overseer didn't notice. He has little patience for half-hearted piety. With prayers done, the day truly begins. We break off by work platoon and head to the mess. Breakfast is a thin gray gruel, ladled out from industrial vats into each person's tin bowl. It's the same thing we had yesterday and the day before, and likely what we'll have tomorrow. Officially, it's called Nutrient Supplement Hash 17, but most of us just call it slime. It has the consistency of sludge and a taste somewhere between burnt cooking oil and protein extract, with a hint of copper from the metal bowl. If you're lucky, it's warmed up. If the boilers are on the fritz, it's cold. Today, it's lukewarm, a blessing. I swallow it down in quick gulps. It's not the sort of food you savor. You just get it in your belly and hope it has enough of whatever nutrients keep you moving. They say it's vat-grown from algae cultures, and the Emperor knows what else. Some rumor it's recycled from corpse starch, that we're essentially eating the dead of Krieg who came before us. I don't know if that's true, but honestly, I wouldn't be surprised or even disturbed. If our ancestors sustain us in death, then that's just another form of service. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, as the preachers like to say. Across from me, one of my fellow workers lifts his mask briefly to spoon the gray mush into his mouth. We don't remove our rebreathers fully, just unlatch the bottom to get the food in. I catch a glimpse of his face. I've seen him every day for years. But I could hardly tell you what he looks like. A thin, pallid face, chapped lips, hair shaved close to the skull. We all look much the same. On Krieg, nobody really cares about appearances. Why bother when we spend most of our time behind gas masks or beneath helmets, and when a disfiguring chemical burn could be waiting around any corner? Vanity is for people who expect to live long and have others admire them. That's not us. We eat quickly, standing up at long metal tables. There aren't enough seats, and anyway, lingering over a meal is not our habit. Within 10 minutes, the clatter of bowls signals the meal's end. Some of the slower eaters are still finishing as the order comes to line up to march out. If you don't get your daily allotment down in time, too bad. Falling out of formation is worse than an empty stomach. More than one idiot has tried to sneak a half-eaten ration with them, only to get disciplined for it. You consume what you're given when you're given it, period. Any whining about still being hungry? Well, nobody actually dares to whine. Hunger is normal. That faint gnawing in your belly is just another reminder that you're still alive and still paying your dues. After breakfast, we disperse to our assigned labors. Like most able-bodied folk here, I have two roles. I'm part of the Planetary Defense Force in training, basically a soldier who hasn't been shipped out yet. And I'm a worker in the Manufactorum lines. In the morning, I'm scheduled for the Manufactorum. In the afternoon, drills and training exercises. The idea is to make every hour count. Why let a soldier in waiting sit idle when he could be turning a wrench or hauling shells? Idleness breeds weakness, and weakness has no place on Krieg. So I join the column, heading to Manufactorum Block C-13, one of the many weapon foundries in this sector of the city. As we march through the tunnels, I pass by a fresco on the wall, one of many murals of the god emperor that adorn our halls. In the flickering lumen strips, the emperor's painted eyes look down sternly, one hand raised in benediction, the other clutching a sword. Beneath that image are high Gothic words inscribed in red, "From ruin, reborn in faith." I've walked past this mural 1,000 times. Sometimes I try to imagine what the emperor might think, seeing us scurry like ants in these tunnels. Would he be proud? Disgusted? Probably just expectant, expecting us to do more, be better, redeem ourselves fully. Not that we ever can. Not that we'll ever have the chance to ask him. The Manufactorum's main gate yawns before us, a set of enormous plasteel doors with the symbol of the Adeptus Mechanicus and the Imperial Aquila stamped across them. Even from here, I can hear the roaring of furnaces within, the clang of machinery, the steady thump-thump of the presses. The heat washes over us as the doors grind open. It's always a shock leaving the relatively cool, stale air of the corridors and stepping into the hot, acrid atmosphere of the forge. My lenses fog for a second and my mask's filters automatically whir a bit faster to screen out the fumes. The tang of ozone and promethium is strong. It never really leaves your nose even after you finish a shift. Inside, it's dim and hellish. Red industrial lighting casts everything in a bloody glow. Conveyor belts rattle with half-assembled munitions. Sparks fly where automaton arms weld and rivet. The noise is a constant assault. Gears grinding, steam hissing, metal on metal. I often wonder if this is what the inside of a volcano sounds like. Perhaps not, but it's what we imagine hell would be if we believed we were allowed the luxury of hell over oblivion. I report to my station along with my work team. There are 6 of us assigned to Section 7G today. The task? Assembling LAS gun power packs and inspecting them for charge and quality. It's painstaking, monotonous work, but vital. A LAS gun's just a fancy club without a working power cell. We stand at our stations and get to it immediately. There's no need for pep talks or instructions. We did the same thing yesterday and we'll do the same thing tomorrow until told otherwise. My hands move automatically, slotting components together, tightening screws, connecting wires, checking the small rune light that flashes green if the charge is good. Twist, clamp, test, next. Twist, clamp, test, next. Over and over, hundreds of times an hour. Above our station, a glowing sign displays the quota and our progress. We're expected to finish 500 packs this shift. The counter currently reads 0 completed. It will turn green if we hit the target, red if we fall behind schedule. It's never turned red in my time here. We won't allow it to. If it did, the overseers would come. Perhaps even a tech priest or a commissar to find out why. None of us wants that kind of attention. For hours, the only break in routine is the occasional shout from a foreman or the stutter of a machine. At one point, the conveyor belt ahead of us jolts to a stop, a jam. Instantly, a klaxon bleats and amber warning lights spin. My teammates and I halt work, stepping back from the line. Across the aisle, I see a robed figure hurry forward. One of the Adeptus Mechanicus tech priests who maintain the machines. He skitters on cybernetic legs to the jammed conveyor and begins chanting binaric canticles, even as his mechadendrite arms delve into the machinery. We all watch silently, some of my co-workers absent-mindedly mouth a quick litany to the Omnissiah under their breath, a little prayer to appease the machine spirit so production can resume. It's fixed in a minute or two. A twisted piece of metal removed, gears realigned. The tech priest gives a curt nod, and the line clanks back to life. We immediately resume our stations. The whole incident maybe lasted 120 seconds, but I know we'll be expected to make up that lost time by the end of the shift. Accidents of another sort happen too. Not a day passes without someone somewhere in the manufactorum getting hurt. With so much heavy machinery and so little room for error, it's inevitable. In my first month here, I saw a man lose two fingers when a press came down too fast. He barely grunted, just clutched his bleeding hand to his chest and waited until a medikai team arrived. They hauled him off to the infirmary, and we heard later that the same day he was back at work, hand wrapped in a dirty bandage, minus two fingers but still turning a wrench. Bionic replacements are reserved for those headed to the front. A mere line worker isn't likely to get augmetics for something as trivial as a few fingers. If you can still hold a tool with the remaining ones, you carry on. Today it's not my fingers, but my back that aches, and my head too. The fumes always give me a low-grade headache by mid-shift, but nothing I can't push through. One of the women, two stations down, isn't as fortunate. She suddenly staggers and has to brace herself against the assembly bench. Heat exhaustion, maybe, or the fumes overwhelming her. None of us moves to help immediately. To do so would be to abandon our post, but I see her try to straighten and fail. She goes down hard to one knee. The foreman catches sight and rushes over. He signals two of us to assist. My neighbor and I step away and lift her under the arms. Her eyes are rolling a bit. She's conscious, but barely. The foreman barks, "Take her out, now!" We drag, carry her away from the line. A minute later, a pair of Medicaid servitors meet us at a side door. They take her from us, and one jabs her with a stim shot to rouse her. We're already turning back to our stations before I even see if she comes around. I know she will. Those med servitors are efficient in their own lobotomized way. Within half an hour, she'll probably be patched up and sent right back to us, maybe with a warning to drink more of the recycled water before shift. And sure enough, later I notice her at her bench again, a little unsteady but determined, soldering wires as if nothing happened. We don't stop working for her incident, nor for anything else. There is no break in the labor unless you physically can't stand. And if you can't stand, you'd better have a very good reason. Being dead is acceptable. Anything short of that, you carry on. The shift lasts a good 6 hours this morning, though time is a blur in the windowless heat. At some point, I realize by the ache in my stomach that it must be near midday. Sure enough, a klaxon sounds indicating the lunch interval. Lunch break is generous by Krieg standards. A whole 20 minutes today. They vary it based on production targets and current needs. Sometimes it's only 10. The Emperor himself couldn't predict what the Munitorum schedule will decree. We line up for the midday ration back at the mess. It's basically the same as breakfast. Another bowl of nutrient slime, maybe marginally thicker. If we're lucky, a sprinkle of salt. On very special days, they add a piece of synthetic Grox protein for extra energy, but today is not one of those days. I wolf the meal down while standing. My feet throb from the morning's toil, but sitting would just make it that much harder to get up again. I see that woman who collapsed earlier. She's sitting on the floor by the wall, too exhausted to stand while eating. Her hands shake as she shovels the gruel. A couple of others from her section stand nearby, not exactly fussing over her. That kind of sympathy isn't really in our nature, but just making sure she's alive and eating. One catches me looking and we exchange a brief nod. There's no shame in what happened, only shame if she'd refuse to continue. We all know it could be any of us next time. A momentary lapse in endurance, a stray whiff of toxin and you're down. If you get back up again, you're fine. If you don't, well, if you don't, then you've finally earned your rest, I suppose. The bell rings before I even finish scraping the last bit of paste from my bowl. Time's up. a swallow of water from my canteen to wash the taste away, and back to the grind. The afternoon for me is not more assembly work. This is when my other duties kick in. I'm part of the local defense youth brigade. Call it a cadet corps or a PDF reserve unit, whatever you like. Essentially, every able-bodied person here is a soldier from the day they can hold a las gun. We train constantly so that when the Departamento Munitorum calls our number to form a new guard regiment, we're ready. Many of my fellow workers from the morning have the same arrangement: labor in the Manufactorum for part of the day, combat drills for the rest. Some others, especially older folks whose soldiering days are past, or who got maimed in one of the endless training accidents, will stay in the Manufactorum through the evening. But by 13 o'clock hours, I and the other young ones — I'm nearly 18 standard years, so probably due to be shipped out within the next couple of years — muster at Drill Hall B. Drill Hall B is a massive underground chamber carved out of the bedrock. Once it might have been a natural cave, now it's reinforced and paneled with plasticine. It serves as one of our primary training grounds. You could probably fit an entire infantry regiment in here for parade, though we rarely gather in such numbers except on holy days or tithe days. The air is colder than in the forges, but it has a strong smell of sweat, gun oil, and old propellant. The walls are lined with banners, mostly tattered or soot-stained, displaying the Krieg skull and wing emblem and devotional slogans like "Duty unto death" and "Steel in heart, steel in hand." By the time I arrive, a couple hundred of us are assembled into squads. Most are wearing training gear, padded flak practice uniforms, training loss guns — they can be set to low power for drills — dummy grenades, the works. We still wear our respirators, of course. I hurry to join my section. Our drill sergeant is already barking orders. Sergeant Kell is an older Krieger who's seen actual off-world combat. He's missing his left arm from the elbow down. Rumor is he lost it holding a bunker against orcs on some forsaken moon, and in place of a hand he has a crude mechanical clamp. He could have gotten a more functional augmetic, but apparently he preferred to come back to Krieg to train new recruits rather than continue fighting with a bionic arm. The fact that he's still alive and back home marks him as unusual. Most of our people never return once they leave. Maybe the Munitorum thought his experience was more valuable here, training 10,000 of us rather than dying gloriously out there. Whatever the case, he's here, shouting in that rasp of his. Part of one lung is augmetic too, they say, which gives his voice a tinny undertone. We snap to attention as he roves down our line, much like the morning overseer, but far more intimidating. He doesn't carry a shock whip or a cane, not his style. But that voice and the weight of his stare are weapon enough. "Today's exercise," he barks, "bayonet drills and live fire maneuver. Squad 5, you're up first for the trench course." That's my squad. There's a flicker of what might be excitement in my gut. The trench course is harrowing, but it sure beats standing in formation stabbing dummies for hours. We jog to the far end of the hall where, impressively, they've constructed a simulated trench network. It's a close replica of the kind of battlefields Krieg is famous for. Narrow trenches winding through mounds of sandbags and scrap metal, muddy ground. They actually ship in some wet soil from the surface for authenticity, as if there isn't enough mud out there already. And even sections of razor wire and stakes. Overhead, arched ceiling emitters simulate a dim, overcast daylight and occasionally flash to mimic explosions. They'll pump in smoke and even low-grade chemical agents to test our response. I've done this course dozens of times, but it never fails to get my heart pounding. Our squad takes position at the start. We fix bayonets to our training loss guns. The rifle in my hands is a battered old Lucius pattern last gun, not actually charged to full power, but enough to sting and leave a nasty burn at close range. It has weight to it, and I feel an odd comfort holding it. This is what all the toil is for, right? All the hours in the manufactorum building weapons, all the prayers and self-denial. It's so we can use tools like this last gun in the Emperor's service. In a way, the gun is an extension of my will and faith. Or that's what the commissars say in their speeches. A siren blares and the exercise begins. We vault into the trenches, running through the muck as if real enemy fire were overhead. Loudspeakers crackle, simulating the zip of las rounds and the boom of distant artillery. The air quickly fills with smoke. My mask filters work overtime to keep the worst out, but I can still taste a chemical tang. The sounds, the grit in the air, even the subtle sting of gas on my exposed skin. It's all meant to harden us, to acclimate us to the realities of war. "Advance!" Sergeant Kell shouts, moving behind us as we push through the network. I grip my rifle tight and step over wooden duckboards across a flooded section of trench. A pop-up target, shaped vaguely like a green-skinned orc, springs up ahead of me with a clatter. I fire instinctively, a red lance of low-power last bolt striking the target. It glows with a scorched mark but doesn't topple. Did I hit it dead on? Hard to tell in the chaos. Two of my squad mates also fire and the target drops. We keep moving. Around a bend, we encounter a section of trench where we must go over the top. Climb out of the trench, cross a stretch of open ground, and then dive into the next trench segment under simulated machine gun fire. This is the part that always gets a few of us. I heave myself up the ladder and scramble over the lip. Immediately, bright lamp flashes simulate enemy fire. We've been drilled. Keep low, move in bursts. I dash forward, mud sucking at my boots. Someone to my left goes down with a yelp, not actually shot. There are pitfall traps that can drop you to simulate a hit. The drill instructors will tally him as a casualty for the exercise. The rest of us push on. I can hear my own breathing loud in my mask as I leap into the next trench, nearly landing on another target dummy, which promptly lurches forward, swinging a padded club at me. A mock melee attack. I parry with my rifle and thrust my bayonet. The blade punches into the dummy's sackcloth torso, and some stuffing flies out. "Enemy down!" I bark reflexively, pulling my blade free. The course goes on like this for what feels like hours, but is probably only minutes. When we finally emerge at the other end, panting and smeared in mud, Sergeant Kell is there taking notes. A few of the others from my squad are with me. I see three didn't make it through, dead or too injured to continue according to the simulation. One limps out later with a twisted ankle from a wrong step. He looks frustrated with himself, and a Medicae servitor quickly hustles him away to check the injury. The other two who fell are fine physically, but hang their heads in shame for having been killed in the exercise. Kell gives them all a cold stare. "Enemies will be less forgiving than a training servitor," he says icily. "Learn from this, or next time we use live rounds." I don't think he's entirely joking. Our performance otherwise was adequate. We're nowhere near as good as a veteran unit, of course, but we improved from last week's run. Kell notes the time it took us and how many targets we hit. He has us gather and critique our mistakes. One of my squad, number 4659, we just call him 59, speaks up to admit he hesitated at the ladder and that slowed us. The sergeant nods, making a note, then unexpectedly says, "At least you're honest, 4659. See to it that hesitation dies here so you don't die out there." Honesty, discipline, self-sacrifice. They drill these virtues into us as vigorously as marksmanship or bayonet techniques. Atonement is the core of everything. We must work harder, fight harder, and complain never. Because in the end, as they constantly remind us, we owe a blood debt. Our world's rebellion centuries ago, the great treachery, the civil war, that sin flows in our veins. Every Kriegsman is born owing a life to the Emperor to pay for that ancient crime. It's a heavy thing to teach a child, isn't it? By the time we can walk, we're taught that we carry our forefathers' guilt like a pack on our backs, that we can only put it down when we lie dead on some distant battlefield, having given everything in his name. It warps you, I suppose, but to us it's simply the truth we live by. To live on Krieg is to live in penance. After the trench run, the rest of the afternoon is occupied with more drills, formation marching, target practice at the range, and a lengthy lecture from a commissar about battlefield etiquette, which mostly boils down to obey orders, hold your ground, and welcome death like a friend. The commissar is an off-worlder, assigned here to oversee certain aspects of training. I always find it a bit darkly amusing that we even have commissars on Krieg. They're meant to instill courage and loyalty in troops to prevent cowardice. On other worlds, I hear, conscripts sometimes need a bolt pistol to the head to remind them why they should fight. Here we volunteer for suicide missions with no encouragement needed. I suspect our commissars get bored. There's not much for them to do except observe and maybe adjust our morale slightly upward if we get too gloomy, even for the Imperium's tastes. This one, Commissar Falk, mostly lectures on proper adherence to the Imperial Creed and occasionally tries to restrain our more self-destructive tendencies. I've heard that in actual Guard regiments, commissars attached to Krieg units often have to hold the troops back from charging recklessly to their deaths. It's a strange flip of the usual script. Still, we respect the commissar. He's a representative of the throne, and ultimately our link to the wider Imperium. He's one of the very few outsiders I've ever seen in person. Picture this: a man in a crisp black greatcoat, polished boots, a peaked cap, and a stern face free of any respirator mask. Yes, he doesn't wear a mask, not down here in the sealed habitats. Part of me envies seeing someone's full face. He looks human in a way we almost forget humans can look, but part of me also thinks he's foolish. All it takes is one leak, one contaminant, and his unfiltered lungs are cooked. Perhaps he trusts our environmental systems that much, or maybe he just wants to set an example of fearless bearing. He carries a bolt pistol at his hip, and I've noticed the way his eyes drift over us when he talks, as if assessing which of us might ever need execution for disobedience. I doubt he finds much wanting. Our greatest disobedience is being too eager to die. The lecture wraps up with a rousing mantra we all chant: in life, war. In death, peace. In life, shame. In death, atonement. Those words echo off the chamber walls, hundreds of voices united in that promise. It's an old saying on Krieg. Some say it dates back to the end of the Civil War, words uttered by the first generation of survivors. It pretty much sums up our existence. Life is war. Literally constant struggle, whether on the battlefield or in the factories or in our own hearts against fear. Peace only comes when you're dead. While you live, you bear the shame of our planet's betrayal. Only by dying in the Emperor's service can you atone for it. We recite this like a prayer, and we mean it. I sometimes feel a chill when I say it, as if the enormity of that fate hangs over me, like the weight of all Krieg's ash. But then the moment passes, and I carry on as I must. Evening comes, not that you can tell by looking around. The lights in the hall are as bright as ever, the cavern sealed away from any concept of dusk. But a chronometer on the wall reads 18 o'clock, and that means training is over for the day. We're bone-tired, caked in grime and sweat under our gear. There's no formal dismissal. Squads simply disperse when their duties conclude. I head back to my bunk area with the others. We move slower now than in the morning, drained from a day of labor and drills. The corridors we march through are as silent and dim as before, but now I notice new smudges of mud our boots have tracked in, and the lingering scent of propellant clinging to our uniforms. Once at the barracks, we each see to our equipment first. That's ingrained in us. Maintain your gear before you rest. I unfasten my bayonet, clean the mud from the blade, and oil it lightly. I wipe down the practice lus gun and double-check the charge pack. It's still half full, no misfires good. My uniform I'll have to wear again tomorrow, so I do my best to scrape off the worst of the dirt and hang it in a locker. We get one fresh set of clothes a week if we're lucky, so I can't be soiling them completely in one go. A quick scrub of my boots and I finally slump onto my bunk. For a minute, I just sit there, back against the cold wall, eyes closed behind my mask lenses. I can't lie down yet or I might not get up for the evening duties. Yes, there's a bit more yet. The day isn't truly done until lights out. This is the closest thing to free time we get, perhaps an hour to ourselves, though to ourselves is a misnomer when you're crammed in a barracks with 100 other souls. Still, it's the time when no one is actively ordering me about, and I could, in theory, do what I want. Not that there are many options. Some of the others take this time to tend to personal matters, polishing a lucky charm, saying an extra prayer, writing brief letters or journal entries. Not that many have people to write to. Most correspondence here is either to comrades at the front or reflective notes that will likely never be read by anyone. Me, I usually just try to gather my thoughts, maybe exchange a few quiet words with whoever's nearby. Tonight, it's my bunkmate across from me, the one with the little Aquila trinket. I see him sitting on his bunk, running that tin eagle between his fingers. His mask is off since the barrack is filtered enough now. His face is gaunt and drawn with fatigue, but he's whispering something to the Aquila, a prayer, or maybe just talking to it as if it were a person. It might have belonged to his father or someone in his bloodline. Bloodlines are a bit fuzzy here given how we propagate, but lineage is still traced in a fashion. I should mention that, the way we propagate, it's not exactly candlelight and romance, if you wondered. The truth is, many of us are born not from a mother's womb, but from artificial ones. Vitae wombs, they call them. Machines that can gestate human life from embryo to infant, bypassing the slow uncertainties of natural birth. Krieg's been using them for generations, with the Adeptus Mechanicus's oversight. It's one of those secrets that's not really a secret. We all know it's happening, but we don't discuss it much. Why would we? It's normal here. A lot of my generation came from a vat. I did? I've never seen the facility where I was grown. They say entire complexes are dedicated to it, churning out babies like an assembly line, carefully monitored for genetic purity. Can't risk too many mutations with all this radiation. Perhaps somewhere in those Mechanicus databanks, there's a file with my gene template or donor lineage, but it doesn't matter. I certainly don't know or care who my biological parents were, if they even still live. We don't use terms like orphan because, in a way, we're all orphans and also none of us are. The entire planet is our parent and the Emperor our father. There are still natural births on Krieg. Some women do carry children the usual way, but even that is a utilitarian affair. Offworlders imagine the joy of a new baby. Here, a birth is just another recruit added to the ranks. The mother isn't coddled or celebrated. She's expected to be back to work as soon as able, and the child is taken to the nursery habs to be raised collectively. I was in one of those nurseries until age 5. I vaguely remember a stern matron with a bionic eye who oversaw our early training. We toddled around in little respirator masks, learning to assemble toy las guns and reciting catechisms by rote. We were never cuddled, never sung lullabies. Instead, we heard recordings of battle hymns and sermons. My earliest lullaby was the distant rumble of bombardment on a training field and the voice of a priest reading from the Book of Armaments. I realize I'm drifting in these memories. Perhaps I'm more exhausted than I thought. A clang of a bell in the corridor snaps me back to the present. Time for evening prayer and final head count. We gather once more as a dormitory, standing to attention at the foot of our bunks. An aged ministorum priest, accompanied by a younger acolyte carrying an incense burner, walks slowly down the center aisle. The priest is reciting the Litany of Penitence. The smell of the incense, bitter and chemical, fills the air. It's said to purify us and remind us of the sacredness of our duty. I let the words wash over me. They're the same every night. By the light of the golden throne, we repent. By his sacrifice, we are bound. We give our days and our deaths to the God Emperor, that mankind might endure. Where we have sinned, let our suffering cleanse us. Where we have faltered, let our blood pay the price. We ask no pardon, only strength to do what must be done. The Emperor is our judge and our deliverer. There's more, but those lines always stick with me. We ask no pardon, only strength. That feels right. We don't expect to be forgiven. We just hope to accomplish enough that maybe, just maybe, the scales balance when we die. The priest ends with, "The Emperor protects." We all respond quietly, "His will be done." And with that, he leaves. The lights dim. Actual lights out won't be for another half hour, but this signals quiet time. We finally have a chance to lie down. I pull off my boots and ease onto the bunk. Emperor, my muscles are sore. It's a good feeling, in a way. It means I've earned my rest. In the near dark, the only sounds are the occasional cough or rustle as others settle in. I keep my mask on for now. I'll likely drift off with it on. It's comfortable enough, like a second skin. My mind wanders as I stare up at the ceiling. The day is done, and if I think about it, nothing particularly special happened, which is exactly the point. This was a completely ordinary day on Krieg. Hundreds of thousands of my fellow citizens did the same as me today. Woke in the pre-dawn chill of an underground bunker, pledged their lives to the Emperor anew, labored without pause, trained without mercy, and offered up their small sufferings as penance for a crime none of us personally committed, but all of us bear in our hearts. Sometimes I try to imagine what it would be like to live elsewhere. A pointless exercise, perhaps, but one born of curiosity. There are supposedly hive cities on other worlds where people lounge about, wasting time, even committing the heresy of idleness. Unimaginable here. I've heard rumors from traders or the rare off-world tech adept that on some planets civilians go to markets full of luxuries or attend entertainments, or even, absurdly, take vacations. The concept of leisure for its own sake is alien to me. What would I even do with free time except drive myself mad thinking? Better to keep busy. Work, pray, train, sleep, repeat. That is the rhythm of life on Krieg, as steady as the beating of the manufactorum presses. And yet, for how harsh it is, I am not resentful. That might surprise an outsider. They'd look at us and see slaves, maybe, or victims. But we don't see it that way. We choose this. Or rather, we were chosen by birth into this duty, and we embrace it fully. If anything, most of us are proud that we get to be the Emperor's instruments. It's often said here that Krieg broke itself rather than let treachery prevail, and that from that breaking we were reborn as the deadliest, most loyal soldiers in the Imperium. We carry that legend like a badge of honor. We have no delusions that we'll ever be heroes fated in triumph or names sung in glory. We know we're just one more wave to fling at the enemy's guns, one more set of hands to keep the Imperium's war machine oiled. And that's fine. That's enough. If each of us does our part, maybe one day the Emperor will grace Krieg with forgiveness, though likely long after I'm gone. I turn on my side, getting comfortable on the thin mattress. My bunkmate across whispers a final goodnight prayer, something short. I catch the words, "Grant me the strength to serve tomorrow." Yes, tomorrow. It will all happen again, unless by some chance my number comes up for deployment. Actually, I heard a rumor that new regiments are being raised next month. Perhaps I'll be in one of them. The thought sends a small thrill through me, a mix of apprehension and eagerness. Eager because to finally leave Krieg and face the real war is what I've been prepared for my whole life. Apprehensive because who wouldn't be, at least a little, knowing what that really means? I suppress the latter feeling as soon as it surfaces. I can almost imagine Commissar Falk's disapproving glare at the mere concept of fear. Instead, I picture what it might be like when I do go. We've all seen picked captures of the surface of Krieg, of course, and some of us have done limited rotations up there to maintain the defense lines or scavenge among the ruins. I went up once for a week as part of a construction crew, reinforcing an observation post at the edge of one of the old battlefields. It was enlightening. The surface is a silent wasteland. The sky was a sickly orange-gray at midday, with clouds of ash that drift and never settle. The ruins of our former cities jut from the ground like skeletal fingers. In that week, the sun was just a pale disk that we glimpsed once through the haze, and its light was cold and dim. We had to wear full protective gear the entire time. Even a minute outside without it means a swift, ugly death from the radiation and toxins. But what struck me most was the bones. Emperor's mercy, the bones. We were digging a trench line, and everywhere, just inches under the dust, we hit bones. Skulls with that rictus grin, whole skeletons or fragments. The remains of soldiers and civilians from the purging and the 5 centuries of war that followed. It's been a millennium and a half since then, but still Krieg's surface is a charnel house. We don't have the people or the time to gather all those dead, so they lie where they fell, slowly crumbling into the soil of our planet. Part of me felt like we were disturbing graves by digging there, but as the overseer on that crew said, the dead of Krieg belong to Krieg. They are its foundation now. Maybe he was right, in a literal sense. Those billions of bones probably are part of the very ground. We live on top of layer upon layer of our ancestors' ashes. One night during that rotation, I looked out over the blasted landscape under a low moon, or what looked like a moon behind the clouds, and I thought, the planet broke itself, but it didn't break us. We endure, built from the bones of the past, unyielding. It was almost poetic in a grim way. I think I finally understood something of why we fight so hard. We have to be as hard as the earth we made, because if we aren't, then what was the point of all that sacrifice? Down here under the surface, it's easy to forget how truly desolate our world is up above, but none of us forget the story or the duty that comes of it. They made sure of that with every lesson, every prayer. Colonel Jurtin, the man who ordered the first atomic cleansing, is as much a patron saint to us as a figure of dread. He taught Krieg the ultimate lesson, that loyalty to the Emperor is worth any price, even your entire world, especially your entire world. We honor him, but we also live in the shadow of that choice. Some say his spirit watches over Krieg still, judging whether we're doing enough. Enough. Will it ever be enough? 20 regiments tithed in a single year, millions of lives fed into the meat grinder of the Imperium's wars, and we still produce more. We'll likely do so until Krieg itself finally can't sustain life anymore, and then I bet we'd still march off into the radioactive dark singing praises until the last voice went quiet. But I shouldn't think of an end. The Emperor will decide when we're done. Until then, we persevere, generation after generation. There's a stoic comfort in that routine, that certainty. I don't have to wonder what my purpose is. It's written on every wall here. It's the chorus of every morning litany. Suffer, fight, die for redemption. Simple. I feel sleep creeping in now. Muscles relaxing, eyelids heavy behind the mask. As I drift off, I murmur a final thought that's half prayer, half personal motto. Only in death does duty end. It's another common saying, not just on Krieg, but across the Imperial Guard. Here, though, it carries literal weight. Death is the only retirement plan we've got, and I accept that. Emperor, let me live long enough to do some good, and let me die doing it. That's all I ask. The lights-out klaxon sounds softly. They even dim the tone for the end of day, a rare show of mercy. The last lumen strips flicker off. In the darkness, I hear someone in the barracks whisper, "There are no civilians on Krieg," and a few others quietly respond, "Only soldiers." It's almost like a lullaby in its own right, a final affirmation of who and what we are. And as I finally surrender to sleep, I know this. When tomorrow comes, I'll wake to the siren and do it all again, gladly. Because this is my life, the life of a Krieg civilian, which is nothing less than the life of a soldier in training, a worker priest of the cult of war, a penitent soul seeking absolution. It might seem hellish, even absurd to anyone else, but to me, to us, it's simply duty. And duty is everything. This is Krieg. We have already sacrificed everything, and we will continue to until the Emperor himself tells us to stop. And he hasn't told us to stop yet.